It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about her new legislation targeting the rising costs of prescription drugs.
First, there are dueling education funding plans in Wisconsin. The governor's budget would increase current spending levels by about $650 million after cuts in previous budgets. But his Republican colleagues in the state assembly have proposed their own plan.
Yesterday, assembly supporters of that plan made their case in an event in Chippewa County. Their plan includes $90 million less than the governor's, and it would give more money to districts who get less under the state's current school funding formula.
That formula was set 24 years ago. There have been complaints over the years about unequal funding between districts, but the complicated nature of the plan makes it a daunting task to try to fix it.
Alan Borsick joins us now with some context. He's a senior fellow at Marquette University Law School and education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, as we said, that assembly plan would tinker with the school funding formula. This is maybe one of the most complicated pieces of Wisconsin government, as I understand it. What does the school funding formula do?
Well, that's hard to sum up, except that it does exactly that. It funds schools, and the bulk of it is from state general revenues. For quite a while, the principle was that it would cover two-thirds of the cost, and it slipped some from that in recent years. But state aid is still a huge issue, and the bulk of the rest comes from local property taxes.
And why are people seeing problems with it, inequalities between districts?
Well, partly because they've been there forever. And in 1993, this is where the 24-year-ago figure keeps popping up, there was a plan adopted by the legislature, largely pushed by Governor Tommy Thompson at that time, for what was called the three-legged stool to try to stem the fairly rapid rise in education costs at that time. And the three legs were, one was limiting how much more teachers could get in pay and benefit increases. One was increasing state aid to schools to reduce property taxes. That's where the two-thirds figure came from. And one was putting a cap on how much schools could spend each year, which became known as the revenue cap or revenue limits, and it's how much they can take in property taxes and state aid and a couple other little things, but that's the bulk of it. So you run the clock ahead to now, and the limits on teacher raises are gone, largely replaced by the impact of Governor Walker's Act 10 of 6 years ago. And the two-thirds commitment has slipped away, but the revenue caps are still there. At that time in 1993, they just put a cap on everything that districts were spending, and there was a wide range of what districts were spending. And it wasn't simply the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, although that's somewhat true. But a lot of richer districts were quite frugal. Some poor districts were fairly generous, and that became the base for building the revenue cap, and it's still the base, and the disparities have become, if anything, more important over the years. And they can be quite wide. It can be almost $3,000 or some cases, a few cases more than that, per year, per kid, which is a lot of money.
3,000-year difference per student in districts. That's a lot.
It's a lot. The column I'm writing for the Journal Sentinel for this weekend focuses on an example. And it's not the worst. And between Milwaukee and Shorewood, which the distance is one width of a street, not even that busy a street, and the gap is $1,200. Well, if you got 500 kids in a school, that's $600,000. That's a lot of spending, a lot of teachers and teachers' aides and resources for helping kids. It makes a big difference.
Talking to Alan Borsick, senior fellow at Marquette University Law School education columnist. He writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Wisconsin's school funding formula and maybe a possible change. Now, what are the assembly Republicans doing? They're saying, hey, we're going to put a little less money in than the governor wants in this increase in funding, but they want to tweak this revenue limit formula. What would they change?
Well, and to kind of correct something that was said earlier, they wouldn't send more money to the low-revenue districts as much as they would give the low-revenue districts the option of increasing their property taxes more than they would be able to now. So a district that has a revenue cap of $9,300 would be allowed under their proposal to raise it by 2 years from now to $9,800 per kid. But that would become almost all from property taxes, which is to say local decision-making, and not from the state.
Politically, how does that go? The governor has been making a big point of holding property taxes constant or even lowering them to the levels of a few years ago. Is this something that, would fly with the governor?
That's a good question. And it certainly is interesting that all this fighting, and it's really pretty intense, is within Republican circles. The governor, the Senate Republicans, the Assembly, Assembly Republicans, the Democrats are just sort of sitting there eating popcorn and watching the show at this point. So I don't know how much the governor will insist on having things his way, and Senator Fitzgerald, the head of the Senate Republicans, and Assembly Speaker Voss were really butting heads in the course of the week. Something will happen, but it is going to be tricky.
Now, some schools obviously stand to gain here. If that limit is changed, they could raise more in property taxes to make up for some of the imbalance. Now, would some schools lose under what the Assembly is calling for as compared to what the governor wants to do?
Well, yes, and there's a number of provisions where that would be true for some districts, but the biggest thing is that the governor, in a move that was really fairly generous to schools, called for increasing overall state aid to schools $200 per student in the first year of the coming budget and another $200 in the second year. The Assembly proposal calls for trimming that by $50 in the first year, which would still have an impact in the second year. So it's a fairly substantial deduction. That's where the $90 million figure comes in. So all public schools, in fact, even probably voucher and charter schools, would lose that $50. And you say, well, $10,000, what's $50? Again, multiply it by the number of students, and it becomes millions of dollars. In the case of Milwaukee Public Schools, it's probably, something like $4 million, just that one provision.
Looking at the revenue cap, the whole funding system as a whole, have there been calls for the state to really seriously revisit this thing and try to fix it from the ground up?
Well, have there been calls? Yes. Have they gotten anywhere? No. The formula's been locked in. When Jim Doyle ran for governor in 2002, that was one of the things he said, is I'm going to overhaul the school spending formula. He appointed a task force. The task force made a report. It died immediately, and no one's really touched that since then, except for all the changes that resulted from Act 10, which weren't really a funding formula change. They were just a whole funding revolution.
We'll leave it there for now. Alan, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That's Alan Borsig, senior fellow at Marquette University Law School and education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Right now, from recent outrage at the drug company Mylan over the price spike for EpiPens to recent price hikes for insulin, many Americans are worried about the rising costs of prescription drugs.
In what she's calling a first step, Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin is joining with Republican Senator John McCain to call for greater transparency from drug manufacturers.
The bill is the Fair Drug Pricing Act. It would require drug makers to justify increases over a certain level.
Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us now. Senator Baldwin, welcome to Central Time.
I am delighted to. Thank you.
Well, you call the Fair Drug Pricing Act a first step in controlling out-of-control prescription drug prices. What would this bill do?
This bill adds a big measure of accountability and transparency to the drug pricing process. You know, I have been hearing just alarming stories from constituents who need to take prescription drugs to extend their lives, to help their well-being, and they're reporting just massive increases in prices. And there's really very little that we find out these days about why this is happening. If you look at studies, it's happening quite broadly among the major drug corporations. And so this bipartisan measure that I've authored along with Senator John McCain requires the drug corporations to file extensive reports on and to provide some sort of justification for their price increases if they intend to increase the price of a medication by 10% or more in a year.
How do you think that transparency gets to the end goal of reining in runaway drug costs?
Well, it's interesting. I think when we see drug price increases, like let's just use the well-reported example of the EpiPen. Parents with a child with allergies know that they need an EpiPen to reverse a severe allergic reaction. And the EpiPen last summer went from $100 in price to $600 in price. And yet there was no indication that it cost more to manufacture, that the ingredients cost more, that they had invested in R&D, perhaps maybe they spent it on marketing, who knows. But we believe that transparency and requiring them to report is a first step that would allow us to get to the bottom of why this is happening. Or it would end up basically confirming our suspicions that they are doing it simply because they can.
Well, to take that example of the EpiPen and its manufacturer, Mylan, they have been accused of having an effective monopoly. They've also taken on a barrage of public criticism from consumers and from the press for raising those prices. And yet, the price is still $600 a pack. So given that, how confident are you that transparency will be enough of a corrective?
Well, I agree that there has been a fair amount of attention on the EpiPen and a couple of other medications. However, this is rampant throughout the industry. Huge percentages of the drug products that the big corporations sell are going up. Sometimes they're raising the prices by around 10% a year, year after year after year, so that somebody who has a lifelong condition will see over the course of a decade their drug prices, double, triple. Other times we see these rapid spikes, but I think that if we had access to information about things like CEO pay, how much they invest in stock buybacks, what do they spend on marketing, what about R&D, has an ingredient cost changed to justify the increase, we'll know whether there's competition for the particular medication, but all these factors are important stops. I think they will actually be a deterrent to the drug corporations from raising their prices to begin with. But even if they're not, that information will instruct next steps.
Now, this bill, it does not prohibit drug makers from raising prices, as you said. It just asks them to report on the justifications behind the cost and increase transparency. Given that, does the bill, do you think, go far enough to protect consumers?
So the bill requires the drug corporations to file their financials in a broad array of categories. They have to do so before they can raise the price of their drugs. They need to do that filing, I think, 30 days in advance of a price spike of more than 10% in a year or 25% over the course of a 3-year period so that drug companies don't game the system by raising their prices 9.9% each year, as some have, by the way. I think that they have never had to reveal that much information. And while I believe it will be a deterrent for some, I also think it will arm and equip policymakers with the information needed to take next steps if we find through these filings that, again, they are doing so without justification because they can. It might add energy and momentum to an issue that I have long supported, which is allowing Medicare to use its vast leverage and bargaining power to bargain with the pharmaceutical corporations for lower drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries and other policies like safe reimportation from other countries where the drug prices are lower.
And I want to get to some of those options in a bit, but first, you've called us a first step, and you mentioned next steps. Do you think that those next steps are close on the horizon, or do you want to see what comes from this first step and see what information is turned up first?
So while I would love to see some of these other measures taken up immediately. You probably recall that I've been pushing for Medicare's ability to be able to bargain with the drug corporations for lower prices for many, many years now. But sadly, those measures to create those reforms have become partisan. And so The importance of this first step, especially when I've been able to team up with Senator John McCain on a bipartisan basis, is, I think, to lay the foundation for future bipartisan action in this arena. I do feel strongly that all of my colleagues in the United States Senate, I'm sure all of the members of the House of Representatives, are hearing from their constituents on this topic, because people are getting squeezed. And at a time when people are struggling so hard to get ahead in this economy, an extra $500 a year for an EpiPen for a child with allergies, people don't have $500 laying around. And so I think if we get this information in this accountability and transparency bill, it would really lay the foundation for quicker action on next steps.
Tammy Baldwin is with us. She's a Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, and she's with us to talk about new legislation that she's introducing with Republican Senator John McCain to require transparency when it comes to prescription drug prices. And Senator Baldwin, you mentioned some options for down the road, among them perhaps making the move to let the FDA import drugs as long as they're safe. And that could create incentives for drug companies to be competitive in their pricing. Do you think that this is something that could be agreed upon by both sides?
You know, right now, the issue of safe reimportation of pharmaceutical drugs does have some bipartisan support. Regrettably, it has not yet been enough votes to pass the Senate. But I do think we need to build on the support that we have. And I would say that I'll give you an example, a Wisconsin example. I recently held a roundtable discussion with Wisconsinites who are really struggling to make ends meet as they contend with skyrocketing prices for, in some cases, life-saving prescription drugs, but certainly very important medicines that they must take. And I was surprised with how many brought in news or advertising clips from their local paper from Canadian pharmacies saying this is how much you would pay for a certain prescription drug. And they were actively looking at that as a way to be able to keep taking medicine that affected their well-being because they couldn't afford to do so in the United States. It's happening now. It shouldn't be illegal, and we ought to move forward on this. But I do think that that is one of a number of helpful policies that would just address this abusive practice that we're seeing from the drug corporations.
And finally, as we start to wrap up, the Congressional Budget Office just scored the Republican American Health Care Act, and they found it would leave 23 million more people uninsured in 2026 than if the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, stays in place. And as a member of the minority party in Congress right now, do you plan to work with Republicans on their health care plan?
So I think that the first thing that needs to happen in order to have a rational discussion on health care generally is that the Republicans do have to put an end to this partisan nonsense of, you know, just trying to get retribution against the previous president with a bill that was nicknamed after him, Obamacare. We have all, you know, we didn't even need the Congressional Budget Office score to know how bad this bill would be for Wisconsinites. But now we have that in hand and can look at not only the 23 million who will lose insurance over the decade, the 14 million who will lose insurance next year, and then the pricing impacts on older Wisconsinites, the impacts on rural health care, the discrimination that will occur against women based on being a woman will be considered a pre-existing condition again in terms of pricing of premiums. All of these things are deeply disturbing. What I hope will happen is as the Republicans in the United States Senate, the 13 Republican men that Mitch McConnell has convened to write a new health plan repealing the Affordable Care Act, they're having trouble even creating a bill that can pass just with Republican votes. I hope that they will abandon the partisan nonsense and come together and we can all write a bill together. And I'm absolutely willing to come to the table. And frankly, as I work with someone like Senator John McCain on the Fair Drug Pricing Act, an issue related to people's health and well-being, we're doing it in part also to show that it can be done, that there are bipartisan solutions to the problems in our healthcare system. Let that be an example, and let's figure out additional ways to reach across the aisle and respond to the need to strengthen our healthcare system today.
Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about the Fair Drug Pricing Act.
With warmer weather now in full swing, local farmers markets are hopping, and things tend to taste better if you cook with local ingredients that are in season and at their freshest.
And this goes for making those sweet summer treats as well. Lei Shishak joins us now. She's a pastry chef and author of Farm to Table Desserts, 80 seasonal organic recipes made from your local farmers market. Lei, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, Lei, why is it a good idea when we're thinking dessert to start with the farmers market?
Well, we really want to be concerned these days with what we're putting into our bodies, first of all. I started gardening about 2 years ago and really caring about what kind of foods and ingredients was going into my body. We all want to live longer and live happier, healthier lives. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that we really want to be supporting our local farmers, and it's really important to be putting money back into our community. And it's so fulfilling to actually get to know your neighbors and your farmers, and they can talk to you about the ingredients and how they grow it and how best to prepare the ingredients too. When I go to the markets, I always talk to the farmers about, well, what would you do with this fruit, or what would you do with this vegetable? And it's really, for someone who loves to cook or someone who loves to bake, it's really a fun way to learn more about different things you can make with ingredients.
And Lei, I got to admit, when I'm at a farmer's market and I'm looking at produce, I'm usually thinking of the entree or side dishes and the desserts. Well, there's bakery stands all over the farmer's market, so I'm covered there. Why look at desserts in particular with that fresh seasonal stuff?
Well, there's so many fun, delicious things you can do with fruits and vegetables. And honestly, all the recipes in my new book, Farm to Table Desserts, they're very simple and straightforward. I feel like you shouldn't mess around with good ingredients. And so when you have a wonderful fresh fruit that is in season, I really have the reader and the cook not do too much to the fruit to destroy it and break down the enzymes. You actually want to use it as fresh as possible. And that way it's delicious, it tastes great, you're eating seasonally, and you're supporting your markets.
So right now in Wisconsin, we've still got some rhubarb out there. Do you have any recommendations for the best way to get the most out of rhubarb and turn it into a yummy dessert?
Oh, yeah. Actually, in farm-to-table desserts, I have a delicious rhubarb cardamom cake, and it's actually makes a wonderful breakfast or dessert loaf, and it's a nice alternative to something like banana bread or carrot bread, for instance. So basically, this rhubarb cardamom cake is almost like a pound cake, but it's got a thin layer of fresh rhubarb in the middle of the loaf, and then it also has this gorgeous thin layers of red rhubarb on top. So it's absolutely stunning with the red rhubarb on top. And that's a wonderful way to use rhubarb as opposed to something pretty common like a strawberry rhubarb pie.
Yeah, I often make rhubarb crisp with whatever other fruit is lying around. I would not have thought of putting cardamom in with rhubarb. How does that pair up?
It's delicious. My parents are actually from India, so I like to use a lot of Indian spices, and cardamom is one of my favorites. It's absolutely delicious, and you must try it. It pairs surprisingly well with rhubarb.
That sounds great. Well, your book is laid out season by season, and as I said, I think we're starting to inch slowly more into the summer season here in Wisconsin. What else should we be looking for at the farmers market stands to get us going?
Yeah, you're exactly right. My cookbook, Farm-to-Table Desserts, it is broken up by season, and the first chapter is spring, second chapter is summer, and so this is a very exciting time for us. We are, like, in the midst of all the stone fruits right now, and they will continue for a little bit into the beginning of summer, but now is really where we see a lot of the berries, like the strawberries and the raspberries and the blueberries, and there's so many delicious, beautiful things you can make with berries.
Well, let's get into a berry recipe then. We've got your blueberry crisp. This is a straight-ahead crisp. It looks great. We've got this on the Central Time Facebook page and at WPR.org. Can you talk us through a good crisp in general and this blueberry one in particular?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you have it up. It's one of my favorites. It's super simple to make. Like I said earlier, I don't like to manipulate the fruit too much, so the blueberries are just tossed with a little sugar, a little cinnamon, and then just a little flour to thicken up the crisp filling. And then it's just topped with a very simple crisp made with flour, brown sugar, pinch of salt, pinch of sugar, and a little butter, and you just sprinkle that on top. It literally probably will take you about 15 minutes to pull it all together, and then it just needs about 40 minutes to bake in the oven, and it's absolutely delicious.
That sounds really good. Yeah, I don't think we have any blueberries hitting the market stands yet. Can you substitute other berries for this or other fruits that would work, you know, that we might see in season right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I am all about personal experimentation, so I would encourage your listeners to definitely try it with other fruit. I mean, if you want to try it with peaches right now or apricots, that would absolutely be delicious.
We're talking to Leigh Shishak. She is the author of the new book, Farm to Table Desserts, 80 Seasonal Organic Recipes Made from Your Local Farmer's Market. And she's sharing some great desserts with us. Fruits are easy to put into desserts. Are there other things that might surprise us that we can put into our dessert palate?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's one that immediately comes to mind, and it's one of my favorites in the book. It's actually called a white fig slab pie. And white figs, they're not quite in season yet, but when they do come in season, they're absolutely delicious. They're very sweet, and they have a very thin skin, so you can just eat the whole fig. And the white fig slab pie in my book, it's a very thin pastry pie dough, and you just simply roll it out. You toss the figs with a little honey and sugar, and you bake it on top, and it's absolutely delicious.
And I think we're about to hit, at least in some parts of Wisconsin, a bit of a heat wave in the next week. I'm seeing some 90s, at least, in the southern part of the state. And you have a recipe that I think anyone can cook on a hot day would be ideal. It's called tomato watermelon pizza. Not a lot of work goes into this one, but it looks really yummy. Can you tell us about that one?
That was a super fun one to do, actually. So the story behind that is my stepdaughter had some extra tomatoes in her garden, and she actually brought over a couple pints of those very small cherry tomatoes, and I cooked with them, and then I was like, oh, I have so many tomatoes, let me try it on watermelon. And so I made this fun little pizza slice out of the watermelon, and I topped it with some tomatoes, and I felt like it was good, but it wasn't quite there yet. And then I decided it just needed something a little acidic, so I put a little fresh lemon juice on it, and I just kind of brought it all together with some fresh mint, and it was delicious. So I definitely encourage trying that.
It looks really cool in the pictures, but really, I mean, I don't think I ever in my life would have thought of putting tomato together with watermelon, and they taste good together, huh?
They really do. They trust me.
Watermelon is more versatile than you think. I'm seeing all these watermelon and cheese recipes now too, so I think we need to expand our horizons on watermelon. it's delicious any way you cook it. Well, looking at, you know, some of the things that are going to come into season that might require a little more baking than watermelon pizza, you have a peach cobbler in your book. What's the secret to a really good peach cobbler?
Well, definitely using fresh seasonal peaches, you know, not making it in fall or winter. You definitely want them when they're in season, and not over cooking them or over baking them. That would definitely be key. And the fun thing with peaches is there's actually many different varieties of peaches, and you can experiment with yellow peaches or white peaches and make it according to your liking.
That's the peach part of the equation. I gotta say, I make crisp more than I make cobbler because I'm never happy with how the cobbler part, the doughy part, comes out. I've tried different recipes. I've tried to be really rigorous. What's the secret to making the cobbler side of the peach cobbler be something that's yummy too?
Yeah, well, I really hope you get a chance to try the cobbler in my book then, because it's a very simple batter, actually. It's actually quite a runny batter, and it's just made with some flour, a little baking powder, so it rises just a teeny bit in the oven, and an egg and some butter, and you just pour it on top. So the trick really was getting it to that right consistency where it's going to crisp up and brown up nicely on top, but it remains just ever so lightly soft and gooey underneath, and that's a true cobbler topping.
Mm. Well, we're talking desserts right now with Lei Shishak, a pastry chef and the author of Farm to Table Desserts, 80 seasonal organic recipes made from your local farmer's market.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Call in for some inspiration from our guest. Do you love making your own desserts, especially through the spring and summer? Do you have something that's a go-to to make from scratch? And do you make desserts with ingredients from your local farmer's market? Are you unlike me? You shop and look for stuff that's good for those sweet treats in the spring and summer farmer's markets, or the fall for that matter. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or if you are on the other side of the stand, if you sell at farmer's markets, do you have some encouragement, some recipes, some ideas for desserts with the stuff you sell? 800-642-1234, or post and find that recipe for Blueberry Crisp on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls and pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our continuing conversation with Lei Shishak, a pastry chef and the author of Farm to Table Desserts, 80 seasonal organic recipes made from your local farmer's market.
You can share your dessert-related questions or comments with us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you making desserts now, this weekend? Have you made some lately with the fresh stuff from the farmer's market? Is there a time of season you're looking forward to at the farmer's market for some great dessert ingredients? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can go over to the Central Time Facebook page, share your thoughts there, and find a recipe from our guest for Blueberry Crisp.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Jackie joining us from Hillsboro. Jackie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I couldn't resist calling in because as I heard you talking, I just took a strawberry rhubarb cookie bar out of pan of cookie bars out of the oven. It's a Land O'Lakes recipe I just got. And I'm just putting fresh strawberry muffins in. And while I didn't stop at a farmer's market, I stopped at an Amish farm down the road and grabbed some fresh strawberries this morning to bake with.
Wow, you're going to town. I want to be at your house right now. I bet it smells great.
It smells amazing. But I bake every day because we farm and I always have people to feed. And so I'm baking for the weekend because I don't want to run the oven when it's super hot this weekend.
Right. And Jackie, are these old recipes or are you trying new stuff today?
I'm constantly trying new recipes, especially with rhubarb. I probably haven't made the same rhubarb dessert twice this spring.
Wow.
Just because I have eager people to try. And I've probably made 20 different rhubarb recipes this spring alone, because.
What was your favorite one before we let you go?
So far, the one that was the best that they liked was a strawberry rhubarb cream cheese bar recipe that came through on Facebook, and we decided to try it, and that was a huge hit. Everybody loved that one. It held together really good, and it was delicious.
That sounds amazing. I'm on board with that. Well, Jackie, thanks so much for calling, and we're getting here, Leigh, at the versatility of the different ingredients we have. Jackie's tried a whole bunch of them already in the year. The growing season is young. Should we get creative and try new stuff?
Yes, definitely. Actually, as she was talking, I was thinking, I wonder if I could do like a rhubarb sorbet where I would poach the rhubarbs and get them nice and soft and then extract all the liquid from them, add a little simple syrup and churn it and see how the sorbet is. So thank you for that idea.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Speaking of getting creative, the watermelon pizza was pretty far up there on the creativity level. Also, you know, we've got melons coming before too long. Cantaloupe soup in your cookbook. Yes. This is not a hot soup.
It is not a hot soup. It is a chilled soup.
tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely delicious. I don't know if you're like me, but I buy a cantaloupe and I tend to eat half of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then I have the other half sitting in my refrigerator for days. And so that's kind of what inspired the cantaloupe soup recipe. And it's super, super simple. It's literally just the cantaloupe and a blender and some sweetener. And it's just garnished with a little fresh cilantro, which, again, you might think sounds odd, but it absolutely pairs excellent with the cantaloupe. And you do add a little milk as well to thin out the cantaloupe soup.
So could you serve that as a starter, or is that pretty solidly a dessert?
No, that's a great idea. You could absolutely serve it as a starter. You could serve it midway through the meal as a palate cleanser as well. That would be nice.
You know, I'm thinking back. Jackie mentioned those muffins, and I think the first time I cooked a thing from a recipe as a kid, I made raspberry muffins with raspberries from the backyard. And do you have thoughts, Leigh, on using these, fresh ingredient recipes for desserts to get kids cooking?
Oh yeah, this is a super super book for cooking with kids. You can actually take them to the farmer's market. I know parents are always looking for things to do with kids, and so why not take them to the farmer's market? They'll get to run around. They'll get to see all the different fruits and vegetables. And you can actually make it a whole day event. You can go Saturday morning, go to the markets. Let's choose something that you want to make something with, then take it home and whip out one of my recipes, and then you can make it with them. And they're very straightforward. Any child with the supervision of an adult could make these recipes.
Well, that's a great idea. And, you know, we were talking about the weather getting warmer and maybe we don't want to bake as much or turn on burners, but you have some really nice simple recipes in here, including one which I don't think of as a dessert, but I guess, you know, it kind of is, market kettle corn, which you can make at home.
Yes, that's very true. I love popcorn. My mom does too. So we find ourselves many times just having popcorn, specifically kettle corn, because it is sweet popcorn, as a dessert. We'll just pop on a movie after dinner and eat our kettle popcorn. It's super simple to make. And I highly encourage everyone to try it.
And I've never made popcorn with peanut oil. You say peanut or vegetable oil. What does the peanut oil do to it?
I just recommend peanut oil because it has a higher smoking temperature, and so it's better for frying with.
We're talking to Leigh Shishak. She's a pastry chef. Her new book is Farm to Table Desserts, 80 Seasonal Organic Recipes Made from Your Local Farmer's Market. Leigh, it seems like you have done clearly a lot of experimenting to come up with the recipes for this book. What's at the cutting edge for you now? What are you experimenting with?
Oh, goodness. Well, right now I'm actually very focused on planting my garden. I just put in some tomatoes and all sorts of different varieties that I'm looking forward to how they taste differently and how they look. And I'm also putting in a bunch of string beans in my garden. So I'm really kind of focused on these different varieties of tomatoes that I have just planted, and I hope they'll be fruiting soon, probably within the next 30 to 45 days.
Now, you've got these delicious dessert recipes going here, but you also have some cocktail recipes. Any quick pointers for how we can use these fresh fruits in cocktails?
Yes, absolutely. I was very fortunate to have a friend of mine, Jaron Singh. He works for Nolet Spirits out here in California, and he actually contributed three delicious dessert cocktails for my cookbook, and we worked together on what kind of fruits we wanted to kind of focus on for the beverages, and I must say I was able to try all of the beverages that he made, and they are all very delicious. He's got a delicious raspberry martini that he included in the book, as well as a cucumber mint limeade. It's absolutely refreshing in the heart of summer with cucumber and mint and fresh lime. And then lastly, he did a watermelon sparkler, which is basically fresh watermelon, a little gin, and a little lime juice and sweetener.
And Leigh, I want to time travel into the future a little bit. One of my favorite times of year is when winter squash starts coming out in the fall. And I've had at Thai restaurants like a squash custard sort of thing. That's a great dessert. But I've never tried to make dessert myself with winter squash. Do you have any suggestions? Because it's such a, and it's kind of sweet. It's a great flavor. It bakes well. So any ideas of how to integrate that into a dessert?
Yeah, I actually have done where I've roasted squash. So I just cut it in half and put a little butter, a little brown sugar, and I just roast that up, and it's absolutely delicious as a dessert.
Oh, just straight up, not even baking it in with something else.
Straight up, but actually, if you want to bake with it, you can absolutely do something like a squash cake. In fact, I have a squash cake recipe in my cookbook, Farm to Table Desserts. I top it with a little cream cheese frosting, and it's absolutely delicious. You just have to grate it pretty thin before you add it to the cake batter.
Yeah, I do a lot of pumpkin bread. I guess conceptually, substituting squash for pumpkin might not be that zany.
Not zany at all.
Well, my favorite fruit coming up is a little sooner than yours, Rob. It's strawberries in the summer. And I always do a strawberry shortcake. That's one of my first things when I know summer is really here is when I'm eating strawberry shortcake. Anything else you think that I should try, Leigh?
Yes. One of my favorite recipes in the book are strawberry hand pies. They're super fun to make. They're tiny individual pies that you can just hold in your hand and eat them when you want. You can actually make them ahead of time and freeze them and just pull out one or two when you have guests or you just want to have a sweet treat for yourself. They're pretty basic in terms of a pie dough. I actually use whole wheat flour and all-purpose flour in my pie dough. And you just cut out circles out of them, and you roast strawberries ahead of time in the oven. Roasting really brings out the flavor and a beautiful color to the strawberries. You put a little mound of strawberries in the center of the pie dough, top it with another round, sprinkle it with some sugar, and bake them, and they're absolutely delicious.
Leigh, good luck with the tomato plants, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Leigh Shishak, pastry chef. Her new book is Farm to Table Desserts, 80 Seasonal Organic Recipes Made from Your Local Farmer's Market. You can find her recipe for Blueberry Crisp on the Central Time Facebook page or check out today's Food Friday page at WPR.org.
To hug or not to hug? That was the question facing comedian Jerry Seinfeld this week in an incident that looked like a real-life version of his old TV show.
Seinfeld was in the midst of a red carpet interview when pop star Kesha came up looking for a hug.
It's hard to just sleep when you're tired, because people are tired most of the time.
Kesha, I love you so much.
Oh, thanks.
Can I give you a hug?
No, thanks.
Please?
No, thanks.
A little one.
Yeah, no, thanks.
Oh!
It was really painful
it's
to
harsh,
watch.
Yeah.
It was hard to watch. She says, I'm Kesha. I love you. Can I give you a hug? But no.
Negative.
Negative. And in the interview, Extra TV, Seinfeld explained why he said, no hug for you.
When you get to be my age and you've done a couple things, you have your own reality.
Yes, I understand.
In my reality, I don't hug a total stranger.
Now, this is relevant here at Central Time because I have a rule about hugs. Always pack a hug in your heart because you never know who's going to need one.
Hmm?
Wait.
I'm so confused right now.
That's kind of the opposite of my hugging policy.
No. You abhor hugs as far as I can tell.
I mean, I have sort of a zone of hug, you know.
I don't
hug the strangers. I'm kind of with Jerry Seinfeld on this one.
A lot of people I find will say I'm a hugger, and then they'll hug you without waiting to see if you also are a hugger, which might be a nice, you know, step to take after that. But I'm for hugs. Hugs are good.
We'll give Kesha the last word here on Central Time.